Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Stan Bernstein and Jason Goff. Afternoons on The Score.
Gotta go, gotta go.
Gotta get there.
So Tiger Woods will come up one shot short.
Well, he's just getting back, being comfortable playing tournament golf. I would think that smile is very genuine. He was very pleased.
Best finish since a tie for second in the FedEx Cup playoff opener back in 2013.
The thing that I was the most happy about this week is that when I did miss, I missed on the correct sides again. And, you know, that's what we have to do out here. And I was able to do that. So my up and downs were relatively easy this week, all things considered. You know, if I missed the fairway, I was on the correct side. If I missed the green, I was on the correct side. So that adds up over the course of a week.
Bernstein and Goff on 670 The Score.
Highlight courtesy NBC. That is not the first time I've heard Tiger Woods make an initial reference to knowing where to miss. That has always been a theme of the way he describes his game. About making sure if he is going to miss, there are certain things or certain areas that are blocked out or certain choices that are made, that to score where he needs to score to win tournaments, he has to have good misses. And not the way I would refer in my game to a good miss, because for me a good miss is when you blade an 8-iron and it hits a rock and it ends up rolling up to the fringe of the green. He's talking about the very finest differences between an ideal shot or one that just lands on a different part of the green or a different area of the fairway, let alone the ones that are just sort of sprayed into the pine straw sometimes. But I appreciate people trying on the comps on the text line, but I am not sure. Josh Hamilton, come on. No. This is, I don't think there's a comp for a transcendent all-time great, for someone arguably the best ever at this, with an in part self-inflicted damage to reputation, to everything. I mean, think about the number of things from which he has to come back into his 40s. Multiple back surgeries. He had a broken leg at one point, right? Didn't he win the PGA that he won against, was it Rocco Mediate when he was on a broken leg? Yeah. There is opioid addiction, sex addiction, and multiple back surgeries, and a complete crumbling, a public crumbling about it of his personal life. I mean, that is... I like that, you know, George Foreman is a good name here. Another boxer. Somebody says, well, what about Muhammad Ali, who literally went to prison for his beliefs and was punished because he refused to go to Vietnam and was out of the game, was stripped of his titles. Did he actually go to prison or just stripped of his titles? I don't remember exactly. I don't remember if he served a day or two. So there was something symbolic, I know, where he was brought in front of the magistrate to have to answer for his sins. But there is – that might be pretty close for Ali to come back and then once again regain the heavyweight championship. That's pretty close. But he didn't have to come back from the number of things. 708 Jordan and the mysterious circumstances of his first retirement and going to play baseball? No. No. And Mike Tyson? No. I don't think – and. No, professional wrestlers don't count. You can stop with that. It's not sports. Yeah, a good point for the 815. Four knee surgeries, too. I cannot. I'm open to possibilities, but I think there is absolutely, when we're talking about somebody who is one of the most influential athletes in the history of sports, who was said at one point to be rescuing an entire game just because of the force of his personality and his ability, that I don't think that you could if he wins a major, let alone two or three or four, but that might be the single most redemptive, powerful comeback ever. Michael Phelps, stop it. No. His own issues too bad. And how many knee surgeries did he have? What, do you have three back surgeries, four knee surgeries?
At least three back surgeries.
At least three,
that
right?
Was the leg was it initially, and then it was back surgery. It was almost like a repair back surgery.
Right.
I want to say at least three on that. This one's ridiculous because obviously he cheated his ass off to get there. But what about Lance Armstrong's return? I don't know what Lance Armstrong was before the cancer. I have no idea.
Yeah, that's an asterisk, though.
Like, because he turned into one of the greatest at his sport, even though being drugged up like all hell.
Right, but we also found out in the aftermath that part of what he was putting in his body might have exacerbated the metastases of his cancer. So that if it's completely self-inflicted in that regard, but
commitment to the shtick.
Well, that was all right. So Lance Armstrong. Do we countenance any Lance? I can't, because those rumors are out there about Tiger too, right?
Sure.
Even though he does look slimmer to me. He does that, the upper body.
He still looks jacked as hell. I know he's wearing the tighter shirt, but
right,
he still looks jacked
as hell. He looks like, he looks in shape and he looks strong, but he doesn't look freakish. I noticed that too. I should have asked Matt Janela about it, but he does not look like a complete physical freak. Because at one point, and I don't know if it was the time when Anthony Galea was centrifuging his blood or not, but there was a time where he was looking with that, you know, almost like that full basketball body. The giant shoulders and the V-shaped back and the tiny waist. He definitely looks normal now, and maybe it's just the ravages of age and everything else. But nah, I can't give you Lance Armstrong. That's a good name, and I should probably be more open-minded, but nope.
Did he even win anything before his illness? I honestly don't know. I know he became winning the tour year in and year out afterwards, but was he good before that?
I don't know.
I don't know enough about cycling to even pretend.
It was always Greg LeMond before that. He was the American that was winning everything. And I thought Lance Armstrong only got great in the aftermath.
Sounds right, at least, because it seems like by the time he started winning the tour, it was always, oh, comeback story. He came off of his deathbed and this.
All right, check this. Check this out. This is, I don't even know where this is. The 239 says, not as much drama, but Ben Hogan came back from a really bad car wreck, and he thinks maybe a broken back to win majors. So look that up. Look up Ben Hogan. And there's also Mario Lemieux's name has now been proffered. Tom in Schaumburg, you're on the score. Hi, Tom. What's up?
Hey, yeah, actually that Ben Hogan one is a good one, but I came up more recently with Michael Vick. Pretty good redemption story.
That's not terrible, but it's a team sport, and it's not like he came back to pull a Nick Foles and win somebody a Super Bowl. So, yeah, he came.
Yeah, it's still really early in the Tiger story to really figure out exactly what the comeback is going to become yet, though.
Right. No, I agree.
Yeah. Okay.
Good name. Thanks.
Ben Hogan, in January of 1950, returned to golf after an 11-month hiatus, near-fatal car accident where him and his wife, Valerie, survived a head-on collision with a Greyhound bus.
Ooh, that's a bad matchup.
Yeah, that's not good. Not quite train level. The train is undefeated still. Greyhound bus is
Greyhound bus pretty
still
bad.
Not beaten.
I imagine the
tied
record.
Tied before, but not beaten.
Yeah, the record for the Greyhound bus is probably pretty good. I've got it up now. It says the accident left Hogan at age 36 with a double fracture of the pelvis, a fractured collarbone, a left ankle fracture, a chipped rib, and near-fatal blood clots. His doctor said he might never walk again, let alone play golf competitively. And while he was in the hospital, his life was endangered with a blood clot problem, leading doctors to tie off the vena cava. How can you do that? How can you tie off your most important vein? Well, maybe there's one somebody would argue is a little more important, but probably not. I don't understand it. After regaining his strength by extensive walking, and thinking. He resumed golf activities in November of 1949, returned to the PGA Tour to start the 1950 season. At the L.A. Open, where he tied with Sam Snead over 72 holes but lost the 18-hole playoff. Then he had the Triple Crown season of 1953. Well, here's actually the difference. Not to take anything away from Ben Hogan. Why do you hate Ben Hogan, Bernstein? No, not to take anything away from the greatness of Ben Hogan. However, the field was different. It was, wasn't it pretty much just him and Snead in every tournament?
I was going to say, and then it turned into Arnie and Jack, and that was it.
Right. It's not like they had an entire world's worth of great golfers gunning for them all the time. But, yeah. But now, this is, I guarantee this is going to come down to me not finding enough proper credit for the comeback of one Ben Hogan from his life-threatening injuries. So, I apologize.
Stop taking on that bus, Ben Hogan.
Right. Next time, stay away from the Greyhound bus. On the fog-shrouded bridge, early in the morning. Yeah, that's rough.
Who are the first old guys you remember teeing off at the Masters? Remember how they'd always do the ceremonial first drive or whatever it is?
Well, it was
Remember Sam Snead, like, yeah. Sam Snead looking 97.
It was Byron Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
And then one year, Byron Nelson just lined one off of somebody's nose.
Oh, God.
You remember that?
I don't, but
like,
I'm going to try to find
it.
For
the honorary drive that's going to smack somebody in the freaking head. Here's,
Byron, put the club down. Yeah. You're not swinging it this year.
Byron, back away from the ball. No, the honorary drive. I remember Byron Nelson. Did Billy Casper do it one year? Oh, I'd have to look that. I guess I didn't really pay attention to it all that much, but it was my, I guess Nelson and Snead were the guys that I would picture doing that. And you always say, oh, yeah. And then you watch a guy like Gary Player now, and the guy's sprinting on a treadmill like a madman.
What's he, like 85, 80?
Now, here we go. Yeah, I think he's closer to 85 than 80, but he's, I mean, his physical shape is, you're talking about freakish. I mean, it's not just with golf. I mean, he's unbelievable.
On November 1st, he will celebrate birthday number 80.
83.
You got to look up that Byron Nelson thing. The Masters tradition of the honorary starters. The tradition began in 1963, and it was Jock Hutchinson and Fred McLeod. Hutchinson was the honorary starter through 1973, and he died in 1977 at 93. McLeod carried on the tradition through 76, and a month later, he died at 1994. I guess Gene Sarazen has done it too.
I remember Sam Snead, and I don't know how old I was at that point, but I remember being like, what is going on here? And yeah, like thinking, God bless America, is this guy old?
Here's the list. Jock Hutchinson, Fred McLeod, Byron Nelson, Gene Sarazen, Ken Venturi, he did it one year. Sam Snead did it from 1984 to 2002. So yeah, Gene Sarazen was one of them from 81 to 99. Byron Nelson, 81 to 2001. Arnold Palmer, 2007 until his death. Jack Nicklaus, 2010 to the present. And Gary Player, 2012 to the present. So it's currently Nicklaus and Player that have the honor. But somewhere there's got to be video of Byron Nelson's wayward honorary drive that was a bit of an oops. This segment, sponsored by Cece's. New crust, new sauce, New York-style pizza. Now at Cece's, grab an extra-large slice of their new meatball pepperoni pizza and new cheesecake brownies for dessert. There's so much to love on the buffet for just five and change. Only at Cece's. Prices vary. Restrictions apply. Bottom of the hour, we are going to talk to Jordan Stone about the way this NCAA tournament is setting up. Got a chance to grab some calls between now and then. 312-644-6767. And it's a quieter day than expected around the NFL. It used to be called the legal tampering period. It was a really dumb thing to call it because if it's legal, it's not tampering. It's the negotiating window for free agents that's open, and the Bears have re-signed Josh Bellamy. They have made the qualifying offer to Cameron Meredith, and they've re-signed Bradley Sowell. Other than that, not a lot going on other than stuff around the league. Hub will tell us all that happens at 5 o'clock. We'll get his take. You've got WSCR, The Score. Grabbing a couple phone calls ahead of college basketball discussion with Jordan Stone here on the Bernstein and Goff Show. Dan Bernstein with you solo today. And we try Orland Park next and welcome Jerry to The Score. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Hey, so when you guys are talking about guys making comebacks, they mentioned, Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali, and they even talk about, Ben Hogan and, of course, what's going on now with Tiger. But one of the things that they don't ever mention is Ted Williams. Ted Williams lost 3 years in World War II and 2 years in the Korean War. And nobody ever says anything about that.
Well,
I guess because – and I believe he even got shot down, if I'm not mistaken, in the Korean War. He's a Marine pilot. He wasn't like Elvis Presley. He went in there and served, went around singing in Germany. I mean, he was actually in there doing his thing.
Right.
So I decided to pass that on.
I mean, I think everybody knows that. I just don't think that that's really considered coming back from something. Had he been shot down and had come back from injuries or a prisoner of war or something like that, I think it would be different. I mean, everybody knew he was proud that he served, but I just don't think that's the same category of coming back from something. And we were asking for information regarding Lance Armstrong, and we got it from none other than Debjit, who says, I'm a cyclist. I follow the sport. Lance Armstrong was never considered a viable contender to win the tour. Says his VO2 max, I guess that's a volume, oxygen volume max, was far below someone like Greg LeMond. He was more of a triathlete than a pure cyclist. Before 1996, he actually had to drop out of 3 of the 4 tours. And speaking of LeMond, LeMond himself came back from getting shot after his first tour win to win 2 more. There you have it. Northwest Indiana, here's Mitch. He's on the score. Hi, Mitch.
Well, I'm afraid the gentleman right there kind of stole my thunder. I'm a cyclist, and, Greg LeMond was absolutely clean. And what that gentleman said is accurate about him. He was shot by his brother-in-law while hunting turkey, and his numbskull brother-in-law shot into the weeds. And LeMond still has pellets in his system. It nearly killed him. And he came back after winning the 86. He was shot in 87. He won the 89 and the 90. And in my opinion, the Tour de France is arguably the most difficult sporting event and most demanding on the planet. He also came back and won the 19, world champion, again in 89 or something. But absolutely unbelievable. And Lance Armstrong basically tried to ruin LeMond because LeMond said, this guy is doing something. Because
I know that.
And he ruined his cycling, his bicycle company. He had bicycles that were going to be worked through Trek, and Armstrong totally destroyed that cycling deal.
Yes, he did. And don't get me started on Betsy Landrieu either and what was done, what Armstrong did to them too. So, but I just want to. So, Greg LeMond was mistaken for a turkey by his brother-in-law.
I'm afraid that's what. Yeah, and I mean, and turkey, this isn't shooting quail with 9-shot or 8-shot, like throwing pepper. This is some heavy-duty loads. And if they had not been able to get a helicopter into that area where he was at, he would have died within the hour.
Wow.
And they never. And if you want to see, in my opinion, one of the most exciting ends, in 1989, LeMond came back in the final stage in the Tour de France, and he beat Laurent Fignon by 8 seconds, and they said it couldn't be done. Nobody could ride fast enough. He was behind. He came and he averaged 35 miles an hour on a bicycle in a time trial and won by 8 seconds. And part of it was he wore the teardrop helmet. He had his hands in the drop position, everything legal. Fignon insisted on his John Lennon glasses and his big ponytail and did not have the aerodynamics that LeMond had and did not think he could lose. And they said that Fignon later in life said that every time he went to get to the mail, he would count in his mind 8 seconds over. He could never let it go that he lost that tour by 8 seconds because of his pride.
No, that is more cycling information than I thought we'd get, but well delivered, Mitch, and thank you very much for it.
Our best offense is our defense.
Right.
We've really sold them on that, and deflections, steals, and then winning the first 3 steps. We're not going to change. we still want to get deflections, get steals, get misses, and play the same pace and space that we play. We want to push it. We want to space the floor. We feel we got weapons, you know, and, yep. and we feel that they're going to have to look at us and say, you know, Dante Ingram's a tough matchup. He's a 6'6 guard, you know, at playing the four spot.
That's a guy you've heard a lot of, and for good reason. That is Loyola Ramblers head coach Porter Moser talking with Mully and Hanley, the Scores Morning Show. And his team is an 11 seed and will be facing Miami. Here to talk about the field of 68 with us in the NCAA tournament is Jordan Stone. You can find him on Twitter at First Guess Pod. He was on last night with Nick Shepkowski. In first blush, trying to figure out how the actual show was delivering all this information, because that, Jordan, that was just bizarre. I don't know how you guys could do it while on the air, let alone those of us who weren't on the air were trying to figure out what the hell was happening.
Well, the alphabetical order nonsense that came out, and then, of course, putting the automatic bids up first, which everybody knew who the automatic bids were anyways, and then combine that with the horrible graphics that TBS used. Yeah, it was a nightmare for us to finally get the show sheet off the computer to see exactly where everybody was going, but we got through it.
And you've had time to look it over now. You've had time to hear the wailing and the recriminations, and something that we were talking about earlier. It looks to me like Virginia didn't get a seeding befitting the supposed one of ones.
Well, yeah, they're the overall number one seed. They should not have any problem with the Kansas State Creighton victor of that game. I like Kansas State in that game. Obviously, Arizona awaits or Kentucky, but I like Arizona, Dan, in that spot. And you know, Virginia, you know, it's all about the defense, as you know, Dan. I mean, this team right now leads the nation handily in overall scoring defense at 53.4 points a game. Their defense is remarkable. There's two elite things in this tournament, I think. Number one is Virginia's defense, and number two is Villanova's three-point shooting. Those two things are the only two elite things in this tournament. You know, it's been a wide-open year all year. It's been that way for years because the three-point line is the determining factor on every game. You watch it. I mean, Virginia knows how to double. You know, they come out, they double, and then they have a great rotation back. But the three-point line is the great equalizer, and that's why any team gets hot, they can win in this tournament.
Including Loyola, who is in that same South region as the 11 against the sixth-seeded Miami Hurricanes. Miami, we know, is a Jim Larrañaga team, and they're going to be athletic. They're going to get after him, but it's a team that has had some injury issues, and this is one of those winnables for an 11 seed, I think.
I do, too. It's winnable. You make a good point that Bruce Brown Jr., who projects to be a first-round pick, middle to late first-round pick in the NBA draft, is out with a foot injury, so that hurts Miami a little bit. But Miami's been coming on. They've got a player, Lonnie Walker, who is very athletic. He'll certainly be the most athletic player on the floor. He's a top 15 draft choice. And what worries me about this game, Dan, from Loyola's standpoint, and I love this Loyola team. Who doesn't? I mean, they all play for each other. Every game there's a new hero. I mean, you ever seen a kid like Clayton Custer be the MVP of a conference at averaging 13 points a game? I mean, that says volumes. This team, I love this club, but this is a bad matchup for them. Miami's going to play a half-court game, too. I was kind of hoping Loyola would draw somebody that was more run-and-gun, more athletic as far as, you know, pushing the pace, and I thought they could frustrate him. I think Miami and Larrañaga, as you mentioned, you know, he's been in the tournament 9 times. He's very, very adept at winning. He's been to the Sweet 16 twice. He's been to the Final Four once. I just don't think it's a great matchup. But as you say, it's a 2-point spread. It's absolutely a toss-up. Just going to see who hits shots. The one interesting thing I think for Miami is Chris Likes, their freshman point guard. If you haven't seen him, he's 5'7". He's been, you know, he almost looks like Tiny Archibald. He's left-handed. He gets in there. He gets to the rack. He's been making really good decisions. So Porter's going to be ready for that. But, you know, the one silver lining might be if Loyola loses that hopefully Porter will be back next year.
Could basketball survive a game to close out the region between Virginia and Cincinnati?
It would be ugly. It would be really ugly. Could they survive it? You know, it's so funny because everybody I talk to, you know, hates watching Virginia play. And maybe I'm nuts, but I love watching Virginia play defense. Maybe I'm in the minority, but I love watching them play defense. You know, in my head, I don't equate a great game to, you know, 110 to 100. Great game, in my opinion, isn't a hugely high-scoring game. It might be entertaining, but it doesn't make it a great game. So, you know, I really enjoy watching Virginia play defense. I really do. And by the way, this Virginia offense is not to be slept on. This is by far Tony Bennett's best offensive team at Virginia. And I think the X factor that people are going to learn this guy's name is DeAndre Hunter, who's really talented. He's the first guy I've seen at Virginia at 6'8", 6'7", who can get his own shot whenever he wants. And that has been Virginia's bugaboo always, is that they can go long stretches without scoring.
The three-point field goal you mentioned is the great equalizer. So one thing that I like to look for, you talk about the reliability of Villanova's three-point shooting. You know, these kids get on airplanes and they get on buses and they're off schedule. They've got more media responsibilities. They're playing at weird times of the day. There could be circadian rhythm issues. Some gyms just aren't conducive to shooters, and there is a high degree of variance. I will look for heavily three-point reliant good teams that are capable of a clunker. Who's on that list for you? It would Purdue be on that list? Looking for teams that need, as part and parcel of how they win, they've got to make enough threes that could just have a bad day.
Well, as you know, anybody can have a bad day out there. I mean, teams that really rely on the three, Villanova certainly is one of them. I mean, Villanova, you know, I've not seen a team that shoots the three like Villanova, which with every guy, you know, shooting that shot. I'll say one team which I was really high on, which I am high on, Dan, and I think they're going to make a big run, is NC State, and they're very reliable on the three. I think Kerry Keats at NC State is a name that the coaching fraternity knows, but the people are going to get to know right now. I think NC State takes Seton Hall, and I think he becomes a national name when he beats Kansas, and I think their three-point shooting is going to be a big factor. They've got a kid named Sam Hunt that comes in and only shoots three-pointers. I mean, that's what we've gotten to. We've got teams like Miami, who you're going to see against Loyola. They've got a kid, Dejan Valsevich, and he only shoots three-pointers. 70-plus percent of his field goal attempts are three-pointers. I mean, it's crazy how many, I'll say this to you, Dan. I don't know what your opinion is. I'd like to see the three-point shot gone. I'd love to see post play come back.
Ooh, no. Because that would take away from what I love so much about the modern NBA game.
Well, how about moving the line back? I mean, I assume you saw the NITs moving the line back to the international line for the NIT this year.
I wouldn't have a problem with moving the line back because that creates spacing and movement and puts a premium on the guys who can really shoot it.
Which would be great.
Instead of everybody just shooting it. I would not be against moving the line back. How about this Duke team compared to some others? Because there seems to be some up and down in their game as freshman reliant as they are.
Certainly. I mean, with Duke, you know, Coach K hasn't really recruited, you know, Jahlil Okafor not included. And I really don't think Jahlil Okafor's game even equates to Marvin Bagley or to the other center on that club. Wendell Carter. With Wendell Carter. But the big men, you know, he's finally got two big men, but now all of a sudden now Coach K has no bench. And I think that's really the key, because if Carter gets in foul trouble or Bagley gets in foul trouble, more likely Carter, then they got to go to Bolden. Marcus Bolden's had a his career has been a real disappointment. And, you know, off the bench they've got Delorier and they've got O'Connell. But, you know, Grayson Allen's going to have a huge tournament. A lot of people are obviously down on Grayson Allen from his antics or whatever. But don't forget, Grayson Allen's greatest game won Duke the national championship 3 years ago.
Yep.
I mean, he came off the bench and he won them that game. His name's in lore in Duke history. I think this team is too inconsistent. The point guard's a real problem. He's had a rough year. He can't shoot, and that's a big problem. So, yeah, I think Duke. I've got Duke, Dan, making a good run. But, you know, clearly right now it looks like Michigan State and Duke in Omaha, potentially TCU and Duke. I think Duke gets by Rhode Island. I like the Rhode Island team. But Dan Hurley once again goes down to Duke here. But, yeah, I think Duke's got problems. I don't have him going to the Final Four. I don't think this is a quintessential Duke team.
Looking at the quadrant of Big Ten teams that made this tournament in a down year for the conference, am I crazy? Because there's something about the toughness of Michigan. And I've always liked this stuff. John Beilein, a little bit ahead of his time, we talk about in using the three of he learned to do at West Virginia, you know, it was Pitsnoggle and some of those other guys.
Kinesis.
Yeah, they are
remarkable.
They're tough, you know, with Abdul Rahman and Bogner. And this is the Michigan team that I've seen is one that you've got to knock them out, or they're going to keep coming at you.
They run beautiful stuff. I mean, they absolutely run beautiful stuff. Everybody can, once again, the three-point line, but they work the three-point line on back doors. You know, Wagner, it's remarkable that Wagner's back. Most guys after the game he had against Louisville in the Sweet 16 last year, where he single-handedly beat Louisville, I thought he would turn pro. He stayed. They're finally hitting their stride. I mean, they were absolutely brilliant in the Big Ten tournament. Beilein's got these guys ready. The big question, Dan, is this week off with the ridiculous Big Ten tournament being a week early to play at Madison Square Garden, is that going to be a factor. They're going to be rusty against Montana. I certainly expect them to get past Montana and then hopefully have their groove back. But I have Michigan going a long way in this tournament. As far as the rest of the Big Ten goes, Purdue, this is Purdue's chance. Matt Painter's really fallen short in the tournament. He's had some good teams. This is certainly his best team. He's a number two seed. He's a very senior-oriented team between, and the one guy that I look to, if Purdue is really playing their game, you know, I think Carson Edwards has really come on. He's had a super season. But the guy that's the leader of that team is Dakota Mathias. If Dakota Mathias can knock down his shots, he's very clutch. He's a great leader. I think Purdue can make a real good run because Purdue really got a nice draw, terrific draw. You know, they Fullerton in the first round, then the winner of Arkansas-Butler, which they should win, and then Texas Tech-Florida potentially, and Florida's really been up and down. So this is a great opportunity for Matt Painter to and Purdue to make a great run and reach the Final Eight and potentially see Villanova in Boston on March 25th.
Porter Mosier, Kerry Keats, Danny Hurley, the coaching name checks that we've gotten so far from Jordan Stone in this appearance. Who else is going to be in the next wave that we're going to start hearing about? Say, wait a second, this is your next shortlist interview guy who's going to springboard this tournament into something greener.
That's a great question, Dan. You know, there hasn't been that many memes bandied about. You know, certainly somebody's gonna you know, Chris Mack, obviously, who's well known at Xavier, seems to be on the block all the time lately. His name's been invoked a lot lately. If you know, if he would leave Xavier, you know, going back to Porter, Dan. Two wins and he's definitely gone. There's no question that Porter will be gone with two wins. You know, if they lose in the first round, I think he gets a contract extension, certainly. I mean, they're going to rip up his contract and extend it. But, you know, as far as hot names go right now, I mean, where I've got upsets coming in is I think South Dakota State, not that that coach is going to go anywhere, but I like a lot of these 5-12 upsets. New Mexico State, I like. But, yeah, there's not that many hot names like there usually are.
It's so funny, though. It sounds so arbitrary that somebody like Porter Mosier, he wins two games here, and all of a sudden that means he's a fundamentally better coaching prospect than
crazy.
If his team were to lose. That defies all logic. What a school should be looking at the entire body of work and the character and ability of the coach himself, and now it's like, oh, it wins two? Definitely gone.
Yeah, it's making a splash. I mean, me and Nick last night talked about John Gross, and that's exactly what happened at Ohio University when John Gross was there. He won a game in his first round. The second game, he was fortunate enough to play a 12-13 matchup in seeds. He won. He lost North Carolina in the Sweet 16, and he was the head coach of the University of Illinois shortly afterwards. That's just the way it works. I mean, they want to show the alums that they can hire a hot coach, and you know, usually it doesn't work out, frankly. Yeah, the more body of work. But it's Porter's body of work, though, is very, very impressive. He's really stuck with his beliefs and his system, and he's got a senior-oriented team and a lot of you know, kids here that have worked real hard. And let's not forget, if Wichita State was in the Valley, it would have been a much different story, I suspect.
Before we let you go, are you a believer, as many are, in upper-class backcourts and having experience to work through some of the bumps and difficulties of some of these games?
I'm a believer in experience, but I'm also I heard you earlier in your show talking about you know, the tankathon,
yeah.
And the beauty of this tournament is, Dan, there is so many great freshmen. This tournament, for people that only watch the tournament during, you know, watch college basketball during the tournament, you know, to see DeAndre Ayton putting up 30 and 18 a night, to see Marvin Bagley putting 30 and 18 and run the floor like he does, to see Mo Bamba now block. You know, I think Mo Bamba will block six shots in the first round at least. There's so many great freshmen out there. Trey Young, obviously, people have heard of and seen his stuff this year, and it will be interesting to see if he can bounce back and have a big game. But I think that's the story of this tournament. I you know, the Bulls in general, yeah, losing is the right thing. There's a reason these guys are losing. There's so many – that top of the draft with those four tall guys, and I include Jaren Jackson Jr., who mm-hmm. is so talented, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he does in the tournament.
Appreciate all the info, Jordan. Thanks a lot for
joining
us.
Thanks for having me.
That is Jordan Stone. He's brought to you by CeCe's. New crust, new sauce, New York-style pizza now at CeCe's. Grab an extra-large slice of their new meatball pepperoni pizza and new cheesecake brownies for dessert. There's so much to love in the buffet for just five and change. Only at CeCe's. Prices vary. Restrictions apply. Coming up at the top of the hour, we will talk about what's going on in football. The negotiating period for free agents is open. There are rumors. There are names. There have been players identified as desirable by the Bears as they sign both Josh Bellamy and Cameron Meredith, wide receivers, to their original round tenders. Sounds like a I have a nice order of original round tenders with some ranch on the side right now. We also, Bradley Sowell, the potential swing tackle, reserve offensive lineman, signed to a two-year deal. Not much more than that other than rumor, but there could be more before Hub joins us at 5. He's going to break down everything going on the Score. That's who's coming up because we've got football to talk. There are people joining teams, or people at least with the opportunity to join teams, as their rights are being kept provisionally. The Bears are doing that. 25-year-old Cam Meredith has got his original round tender that would pay him $1.907 million. And because neither he nor Josh Bellamy was drafted by the Bears retain the right of first refusal if either player signs an offer sheet with another club. There is also an expectation, at least according to Brad Biggs of the Tribune, that they are going to tender Bryce Callahan, protecting their rights to their slot cornerback. So they're keeping some guys. I've got to tell you, I'm not excited about any of this news. This is nothing where you say, hot damn, the Bears are on the move. No, not really. But Minnesota's kicking the tires on quarterbacks. Jimmy Graham rumored to be grabbing the eye of the Packers. And veteran running backs are talking to the Detroit Lions. All of that and more. That discussion comes your way with Hub Arkish next on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.